My hope in terms of what might come of our current anti-global moment is a new rethinking of the architecture of globalization, an effort to make it more stable, more fair, in order to save it.
Herzlich willkommen and welcome to a new English language episode of History and Politics, the Körber Stiftung's podcast dealing with the multiple ways in which the past matters for current affairs. I'm Gabrielle Wojdelko and I will be your host for the next approximately 40 minutes. For more than a decade, the world has been living through multiple challenges and crises, and it continues to do so. We are looking at disruptions of international financial markets, on the interruption of supply chains due to a global pandemic, migration flows due to humanitarian crises or demand for workers, and last but not least, the Russian war against Ukraine. All this has questioned globalization and led to anti-global movements and tendencies. On this background, I've spoken to historian Tara Zahra about the past and present of anti-globalization. Is globalization as such really unstoppable or inevitable? Which parallels can we identify between anti-globalization movement of the 1920s and 1930s and today? What role does democracy play in the context of globalization? And why did and why do people, political movements or other actors decide for protectionism and nationalism? This is what Tara and I discussed during our conversation. Tara Zahra is professor of East European history at the University of Chicago, and her research focuses on the transnational history of modern Europe, on migration and nationalism. Her very latest book, Against the World, Anti-Globalism and Mass Politics Between the World Wars, has been published in 2023, and a German version has just come out in spring 2024. Tara, thank you very much for being with us in our History and Politics podcast episode.
Happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So we will base our conversation on your latest book that is called Against the World, Anti-Globalization and Mass Politics Between the World Wars. And if I understood it correctly, your main argument in that book is that globalization as such is not unstoppable or inevitable, and that the deglobalization of the 2020s, I mean of the current times, has parallels to the 1920s and 30s. So let's start with the 1920s and 30s. Let's start with history. Where do you see the main characteristics of deglobalization in that period?
Right. So this was a really big rupture. The First World War was a moment when a lot of the acceleration of globalization that had been taking place in the previous two decades just came to a really sudden halt. First, with the cessation of mass migration across the Atlantic. So steamship travel with passengers basically stopped. And then also with trade. And so coming out of the war, it wasn't as though all of that just started up right away again. In fact, migration restrictions that had been put into place during the war in the name of security were actually tightened and continued in the name of all sorts of causes, including racial and eugenic forms of discrimination. And there was a massive shift toward a kind of search to achieve greater self-sufficiency in the economy, pretty much globally. And that's kind of an interesting part of the story, that it's a sort of global, anti-global moment.
I mean, if we talk about the period after the First World War, economy is one aspect, but also what happened after World War One is the fall of the empires and the kind of emergence of democratic nation-state movements, also nationalism, of course. But Let's stick to democracy for a moment. What would you say, what kind of impact did the democratization and the empowerment of a broader mass of people have with regard to the deglobalization?
Right. Well, I mean, this is something you can even see the origins of before the First World War, because, of course, anti-global activism didn't just start with the war. It started with the rise of globalization itself, but also with the rise of mass politics, really in the 1880s and 90s, which happened at the same time. And that intensified after World War One, where you had all sorts of people entering the electorate and also who had been mobilized during the war to protest in the streets, including women and workers and colonial subjects. And basically what it meant is that the people who were most negatively affected by globalization, or those who thought that they were negatively affected, and those are sometimes two different things, had the power to speak back, whether it was in the streets or at the ballot box. They had an opportunity to make their voice heard. So democratization, I would say, in some way contributed to the rise of anti-globalism.
Because before World War One, if I read your book correctly, you quote Stefan Zweig and others who are very positive about globalization, or the, let's say, the global connections before World War One, but that particularly only referred to elites who could travel and who could benefit from the globe being intertwined, right?
Right. Well, I mean, I think certainly it's not to say that nobody who was an elite didn't benefit from globalization. Obviously, the higher wages that were attracting workers to move from Warsaw to Chicago or New York meant that those people also believed that they were benefiting. But certainly the kind of cosmopolitan world that Zweig describes, where you could travel the world without a passport and nobody would ever interfere with you, and or John Maynard Keynes describes being able to order all the products of the world from your bed and have them delivered the next day, that's a kind of globalist utopia that was only accessible to people with certain means and a certain race and a certain status.
Let's look a bit closer at the ideological background of the anti-globalization movement after World War One, because we already talked a bit about democratization. I also mentioned nation states very often, explicitly in Central and Eastern Europe, that was linked to nationalistic movements as well. But at the same time, we had the Bolsheviks, the left extremists, so to say, the communist ideology, that also had a certain view on globalization. So where would you say, what were the differences between the ideological differences with regard to globalization on the right, on the extreme right, and on the extreme left?
Yes. I mean, I think what's interesting here is that whereas on the one hand, anti-globalism was very politically promiscuous in the sense that it spanned the entire political spectrum, both the victims of globalization that were identified and the causes were understood very differently. So on the far left, you know, the victims of globalization were the workers, of course, who were exploited. And the solutions often involved, first of all, more political globalism, right, through the spread of communism throughout the world, but also measures that would in some way alleviate the inequalities that were extreme inequalities globally and domestically that were caused by globalization. That was one vision on the left. And then on the far right, I would say the victim of globalization was more typically understood to be the nation itself, the nation, but also I would say artisans and trade workers, people who were kind of negatively affected by the rise of big department stores and chain stores, and the kind of enemies or the causes of all of this misfortune were often identified as foreigners, as immigrants, as Jews who were seen to embody a certain form of cosmopolitan globalism, and as, you know, basically internationalists more generally.
Okay, and you know, let's make a fast move forward to our times, to our, let's say, to the 21st century, you know, in your book, you argue that there are certain parallels between the 1920s and the 2020s with this current anti-globalism movement. So what would you say, what are the similarities between the ideological backgrounds that you just described from the 1920s and 30s and today's anti-global movements?
Right. I mean, this was a book that I was really inspired by current events and sort of seeing the rise of anti-globalism, I would say, especially since 2016, made me see the interwar period really differently. And some of those parallels are just incredibly obvious. I mean, first of all, there was a moment after the collapse of communism, I would say, that through the 1990s and the early 2000s, that a lot of the talk about globalization kind of presumed that it was inevitable, that it was inherently good, that it would bring more prosperity to everyone, and so on and so forth. There were always people contesting that view, but that, I would say, was the dominant perspective. And that was also true in the late 19th century and early 20th century, when there was a lot of optimism about globalization and its potential to bring about a better world. So one parallel is just kind of the world that led up to this rupture. I guess a second is simply the intense focus on migrants and migration as a sort of, as an emblem of globalization and its perils. I think that was really one of the first signs of this anti-global turn in the 21st century, was the rise of Donald Trump, of the vote for Brexit, and of populist anti-migrant parties and governments throughout Europe. That idea that migration was really causing instability and inequality domestically was very powerful then and now. And then this focus on autarky, or achieving greater self-sufficiency, which really intensified during the pandemic, when suddenly global trade and migration was cut off. There's a real parallel there to the First World War, when the naval blockade, the Allied naval blockade, which prevented food and essential supplies from getting to the Central Powers, sort of through, you know, the lesson learned by civilians was that it was very dangerous to rely on imports for food and basic necessities. And I would say the pandemic kind of drove home a similar lesson globally, which is that if you are relying on imports for basic medical supplies, for food, for the things that make the economy run, in the event that there is a rupture of some kind, you're really out of luck. And so a shift toward home production, onshoring instead of offshoring, and a general kind of, even sort of a popular back to the land homesteading movement. You see a lot of this kind of content on social media now, homesteading advice and that kind of thing. That's another parallel. So it works both at the level of governments, but also, I would say, individuals and social movements.
And would you say that the Russian invasion of Ukraine accelerated that development further?
Absolutely, because, I mean, energy independence has long been a concern, you know, especially certainly in the United States. You know, the idea that depending on foreign oil puts you in all sorts of vulnerable positions in the case of geopolitical crisis. And so I think the Russian invasion of Ukraine really forced a lot of governments and people to rethink their own dependence on Russian oil specifically.
Now we've already spoken about the similarities. Let's talk about the differences. There is one quote from your book, which I would like to bring up here. And there you say, anti-globalists today tend to focus on goods and on people, not on capital. So what do you mean by that with regard to the main difference?
Well, during the interwar period, one of the really striking and dramatic kind of symptoms or symbols or effects of anti-globalism was the collapse of the gold standard. The gold standard had been the motor of international financial integration, and shifting away from it was a dramatic step away from global integration. Now, we don't have the gold standard anymore, but we do have heavily integrated global financial markets. And you really didn't see a lot of attention to that, we haven't seen as much attention to that. I mean, I would say with the exception of the invasion of Ukraine, where there was a lot of movement, at least initially, to pull investment out of Russian markets and so on and so forth, even during the pandemic and before that, there was not a lot of focus on the movement of capital around the world. I think largely because it's less visible to the popular audiences that anti-global rhetoric is often aimed at appealing to.
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting point. Let's focus a bit, because now we've been to the 1920s and 1930s, and then, as we all know, another world war followed. So 1939, 1945, a lot of bloodshed again, with, you know, unbelievable atrocities caused by Nazi Germany. So what would you say, if you look at what happened after 1945, there was an attempt to reconstruct globalism and the global economy as a consequence of the bloodshed, and economic advancement for all and social security seemed to be, was seen as the main aim, at least I would say in the Western part of the world, but maybe even in the Warsaw Pact and the communist countries. But obviously we are back to anti-globalism today. We've got this idea to reconstruct globalism after 1945, and obviously it failed. So where do you see the main shortfalls in the period after the Second World War?
Well, I think that the Bretton Woods agreements had a lot to say for them, that they really did actually try to find a middle ground between the extremes of liberal globalization and a welfare state, full employment, global economic development. I think the shortfalls, honestly, partly came because of the Cold War, which, you know, precipitated a shift from a much more multilateral vision to a bilateral one of U.S.-Soviet competition. So that really undermined some of the principles of the Bretton Woods Agreement to start. And then the oil shocks of the 1970s, you know, largely, this is not my period of expertise, but I think historians largely agree that that was the moment that truly kind of killed off what remained of a lot of the Bretton Woods agreements. But, you know, even to this day, I mean, you know, the National Health Service still exists in the UK. I think Keynesian economics in some ways is really back since 2008 in particular, you know, that government, at least in the United States, I think, you know, the idea of spending your way out of economic crisis rather than imposing austerity, at least here, that has been the dominant approach, I would say. So I don't think it's entirely dead. That's an optimistic view, but it's been deeply undermined. And I think my hope in terms of what might come of our current anti-global moment is a new rethinking of the architecture of globalization, an effort to make it more stable, more fair, to address some of the underlying, the extreme inequalities caused by globalization over the last 20 years. In order to save it, right? You know, reforming capitalism in order to save capitalism is not a new prescription. But I think we're in another moment where, you know, the optimistic view is that that's where we might be headed.
That's a challenge. Let's briefly refer back to the post-Second World War period. I know that this is not your particular expertise as a historian, but you mentioned the economic, let's say, the different crises. You mentioned the Warsaw Pact and the Cold War, but looking at the international institutions that were founded after the Second World War, obviously to compensate for the League of Nations that had failed, would you say that these international institutions and the way they were built also had a certain contribution to an anti-global movement?
That's an interesting question.
I mean, you know, when I read your book, I came across some parts where you at least argue that the international institutions of the post-Second World War period to a certain extent reproduced inequalities, or let's say a colonial view of, you know, looking at countries and areas of the world as if they were on different levels. And, you know, there was no equality built in.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Yeah, now I see where you're going. I mean, the International Monetary Fund, of course, the whole kind of ways in which global aid was administered, typically, you know, in exchange for extreme measures of austerity. And by turning over your finances and turning over control of your economy to outside forces dominated by the United States, that, you know, certainly reproduced a colonial dynamic. And there's a really great book by Jamie Martin that I would recommend that is really focused specifically on this issue. But what's interesting is that he dates this back to the interwar period, and specifically to the League of Nations effort to rescue Austria in the 1920s from its extreme economic crisis, which already was a moment where these kind of practices that previously had only been implemented in colonial governments were sort of integrated into international financial regulation and systems. So that is absolutely a kind of legacy of a vision of globalization that was not taking place on equal terms, but was rather one of extreme inequality that was then reproduced.
And it was also a vision of globalization that did not refer at all to some of the more visionary ideas of the 1920s, when, you know, people were dreaming about people's governments and, you know, grassroot democracy, getting rid of, let's say, governments and focusing on self-governance by the people. So that had nothing to do with it, obviously.
Although one thing that is different and interesting is that I think while the United Nations was initially envisioned, you know, as Mark Mazower has argued, to kind of continue the global power of the UK, of you know, or to replace the imperial power of the British Empire, it gradually became a huge forum for anti-colonial agitation. And I don't think that was the intention of the founders, but that was kind of an unintentional development. So, you know, history is very unpredictable in that way. And that's another kind of lesson of the book, is that all of these efforts to restrict globalization and global trade, migration, have often produced new avenues for globalization, have produced kind of innovation or ways around those restrictions.
And this maybe also goes for the 1990s and then the neoliberal era, where everybody was dreaming about, you know, economic liberalism and open borders and, you know, after the fall of the Iron Curtain. And there was Bill Clinton's famous electoral campaign where he said, it's the economy, stupid, which in the other way around would mean that as long as everything is okay with economy and economic benefits, this will lead to democratization. And obviously, this has failed, hasn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think in large part because the, you know, the fundamental principle of, you know, 1980s neoliberal economics, that like the wealth would just trickle down and everybody would live happily ever after, turned out not to be true. And instead, what we've seen is a huge increase in inequality. So, I mean, it is the economy, but the economy didn't function the way that it was promised to. And so it now, you know, this is a kind of moment of reckoning.
So would you say that the 1990s are another major turning point when it comes to the emergence of anti-global movements, maybe comparable to the 1920s and 30s? I mean, is there a parallel between these two eras as well?
I would see the 1990s being more akin to the decade before the First World War or the 1890s. I mean, I think this was a moment where there was a huge amount of confidence in globalization, but sort of murmurings beneath the, you know, the kind of inklings beneath the surface that all was not well. And I think also it's, you know, the 1990s, it's a decade that historians are just starting to turn to in a serious way. But if you look at kind of how shock therapy was introduced throughout the socialist world and the consequences of that, you know, and the NAFTA agreement and the consequences of that sort of, you start to see that, like, you know, by the end of the 1990s, by 1999, you have the World Trade Organization protests already. So it's starting to generate opposition. But I would say the kind of real momentum for anti-global politics, in my mind at least, it begins in 2008 with that global financial crisis. I mean, that may be a very U.S.-centric perspective, though, you know, sort of.
Not necessarily a U.S.-centric perspective, because also here in Europe, I think 2008 was the major turning point where people and governments came into a crisis mode and then certainly started to ask questions, substantial questions against the financial system. And then the whole debate about austerity came up within the European Union. I mean, yes, I would agree that was the major shift.
Yeah. I mean, the crisis in Greece and all of that, I think that was a big moment.
Exactly, yes. Tara, let us again do a fast move forward to let's say 20, 21, 22, 24. I'm interested in imperialism and neo-imperialism and its effect on globalization or anti-globalization. Because when you said earlier, or you described what happened after the First World War with the fall of the empires, and this then, you know, led to an anti-global movement, as we were talking about already. Now, looking at governments and states such as Russia and China, but also Turkey and elsewhere, they have imperial ambitions based on power play, on geostrategic strength, and so forth. But at home, in order to maintain power at home, these governments need to deliver on, let's say, certain kind of prosperity and security. So how does that go together, you know, with neo-imperialism and imperialist aggression, as in the case of Russia, leading to sanctions, leading to the cutting off trade on the global level, at least to a certain extent? How can neo-imperialists still deliver at home? Is that possible at all?
Right. Well, what's interesting here is there is also a really powerful parallel, because on the one hand, after the First World War, you saw the collapse of all of these continental empires and the beginnings or the intensification of anti-colonial nationalism in overseas empires like the UK. However, at the same time, the desire for autarky also really drove a lot of the imperial fantasies and projects and aggression of interwar states like fascist Italy and Nazi Germany. So, you know, the idea was that the more empire you had, the more resources you had, and the more independence you had, and the more power you had. So on the one hand, I think, when Russia invaded Ukraine, a lot of historians, at least, were sort of, you know, we were all taken by surprise and also a little shocked by the return of a kind of imperialism really focused on land grabs, which sort of, it seemed like a throwback, but it is a throwback in a way to that era of kind of just trying to consolidate resources through the, you know, expansion of space. And it's easy to forget that, you know, also in the 1930s, when Mussolini invaded Abyssinia, the response was sanctions. Not that they were very effective in the end, but there was also that kind of trade-off between expanding your empire in order to increase your global power and influence and to be a big player on the world stage, and then being sort of cut off or becoming a pariah. So I think in some ways the dynamic that we're seeing today is similar. If history is any indicator, I think, you know, the question you were sort of alluding to is how can these governments actually provide what they promise? Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, you know, Mussolini and Hitler couldn't provide it through imperial expansion. And that was kind of the beginnings of their loss of popular support domestically was when sort of the effects of these kind of, for example, just to take Italy, you know, by the end of the war, Italy was much more independent in food production, but the people were getting a lot less calories and a lot less quality in terms of their food, and it was sort of starting to produce already a domestic crisis. So, I guess it remains to be seen, but I would think that at a certain point, the kind of forms of deprivation that result from these kinds of policies will come back to bite these leaders. On the other hand, you see these alliances emerging between Russia and China. And, you know, so it's possible that those domestic demands for economic growth can be satisfied through those kinds of alliances. You know, I mean, China is kind of a really interesting example here. So we'll see.
We'll see. And also we in the, let's say, in the liberal West, we are dependent on economies that are intertwined. We are dependent on imports to a certain extent. So I'm wondering whether at the end of the day, despite of all the parallels you described, these neo-imperial governments or politicians, however you call them, whether they cannot be sure that in the 21st century, realpolitik, as we call it in Germany, so the pragmatism, will avoid to lead to a similar anti-globalization movement that we saw in the 1920s and 30s, so that we just cannot afford a similar way of anti-globalism.
It's possible. I mean, it's possible that the world is just much more intertwined now in a way that, I mean, I think we've seen, you know, in 2020 that globalization, again, is not a sort of unstoppable train or, you know, a snowball that keeps getting bigger. It can pause, it can reverse, it can change directions, but it's unclear. Historians are bad at predicting the future. So yes. I don't really know what will happen next.
Yes. Well, one of my very first lessons whenever talking to historians is whenever you ask them about the future, they get nervous. Now, my almost last question to you is a question to the historian, because when we talk about globalization and anti-global movements in the longer historical perspective, couldn't one also say that what we are observing at the moment is just a normal, in quotation mark, historical trend? You know, at the moment we have a decline of globalization. Okay, we had that before. Then, you know, strong global movements came up again. So isn't it like a very regular way of history to proceed that we are moving back and forth? I mean, could this make us more relaxed about what's happening? Not, of course, what's happening with Russia and Ukraine. I'm not talking about the war, but about, let's say, the anti-global wave that we are seeing.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know, you know, if the pendulum theory of globalization is kind of an accurate way of understanding these trends, in the sense that globalization and anti-globalism are always taking place almost at the same time as well. But I do think that if we're looking for sort of reassurance, it is that the outcomes are unpredictable in a way, that it's not a sort of inevitable kind of runaway train toward fascism or something like that, but rather that the relationship between globalization and anti-globalism is one that kind of produces change and new forms of globalism or reforms to globalization that can be productive. So to that extent, I think that the tension is inevitable and it is probably productive. Maybe that's a way of seeing it from a historical perspective that's kind of reassuring. I don't know if it's reassuring.
No, I mean, it's a bit like trying to predict the future. But my final question refers back to what you said earlier on in our conversation. You said you are an optimist and you have this idea that we probably could reinvent globalism, but safeguard democracy and make globalization more fair. So how could that happen? What would be your advice to citizens like you and me, who obviously want to safeguard the advantages of and achievements of a global exchange of ideas, goods and people, because we benefit a lot from that? So what's your advice?
Well, I think that we need to recognize the extent to which, whether it's domestically or internationally, the sort of wealth that we enjoy is often dependent on extraction from others, and that if you live in a globally connected world, that also, it's not just an opportunity to profit. It also imposes certain obligations toward others and toward ensuring that everybody gets a share of the pie. So, you know, I don't know exactly what policies are going to best achieve those goals, but certainly, and we have to think about economic redistribution, you know, at every scale, local, national and international.
So in the end, it's again, the economy, right? Isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you very much, Tara, for this conversation.
Thank you. This has been really interesting and I'm very grateful.
This was our History and Politics podcast episode with Tara Zahra on the historical pretexts of current anti-globalist tendencies and movements. If you are now interested to learn more about Tara's book and on her conclusions on what to learn from the past about the current downturn on globalization, you can easily find additional information in our show notes. If you would like to listen to other English language episodes of our History and Politics podcast, just scroll down in your podcatcher and you will very quickly find a couple of episodes in English, either as part of our special series The New Germany that deals with implications of Zeitenwende for Germany, or some other relevant topics such as the role of Ukrainian historians during the ongoing Russian war against their country and the historical background of current disinformation campaigns. Thank you so much for listening. If you like our podcast, we'd be happy if you subscribe to it. But I guess you have done that already anyway, haven't you? We'd also be happy if you'd recommend us to others. If you are interested in the other work that we do at our History and Politics Department at Körber Stiftung, please check out our website at www.körber-stiftung.de. Stay tuned, all the best, goodbye and tschüss from Hamburg.